Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
When you hear this music, do you think of Ken Burns? He's with us now, the documentary filmmaker who has produced PBS historical classics on the Civil War, which had this theme by Jay Unger, World War II, baseball, now Prohibition. He's working on one about the Vietnam War, too. Ken is here today partly because PBS is re-airing his four-part Civil War film that brought him to prominence in 1990. Ken has also just launched a national project on civility and democracy. Hi, Ken Burns. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
What's the story you tell about that music and Bob Hope?
Well, I remember sometime after the Civil War was first broadcast 20 and a half years ago. It hardly seems like yesterday, but I had gone to some banquet and with some cheesy band. And as I went up to give my remarks, the band struck this up. And I had this sort of Bob Hope moment that it was thanks for the memory that I would, wherever I went, a shoken farewell would trail me.
That
but
song.
That's not a bad version to play. Jay, having Jay play it is better than having a cheesy orchestra do it. So thank you. It's still one of the most beautiful pieces of music I've ever heard.
And we'll come back to the Civil War. But I want to ask you first about the Civility and Democracy Initiative. This is related somehow to your Prohibition film?
It's been tied into it. It's something that I've felt for a really long time. Arthur Schlesinger Jr., the late historian, used to say that we suffer today from too much pluribus and not enough unum. And he's right. There are very few things in these cynical days that remind us of the union that delivers our collective but also personal blessings. And I see that quite often in American history our discourse decays and we begin shouting at each other and not speaking with each other. Very obvious given the climate of today's conversation. And so we realized as we were finishing, and the we is Lynn Novick and Sarah Botstein and I, who are the principal producers of a three-part, six-hour history of Prohibition, which will air this fall on PBS, we realized that so many of the elements that went into this unexpected thing, this amendment that actually limited human freedom, where all other amendments sort of expanded it, and the only one that's been repealed, had an incredible backstory that it wasn't just Model Ts careening around rain-slick Chicago streets with Tommy guns blasting. We have that. Mm-hmm. But there's a much deeper dive that we could take with that, and a lot of it has to do with how people talk to one another.
And it's funny or counterintuitive because when we think of lack of civility in politics today, I think the things that come to mind are more like people comparing Bush or Obama to the Nazis and things like that. Remember John Stewart's rally to restore sanity and maybe putting crosshairs on political enemies lists, as Gabrielle Giffords had decried before she was shot, whether or not it was, you know, the shooting was related. That's pretty different from the Prohibition context,
we would think. So let me back up and say, let's pretend you don't know what the next film is and that I told you that I'm working on a film about single issue political campaigns, wedge issues that metastasized with unintended consequences, that I'm talking about unfunded mandates. I'm talking about the demonization of immigrants. I'm talking about smear campaigns against presidential politicians. I'm talking about a whole group of people that feel that the country's gotten away from them and they want to take it back. Well, you'd say, oh, you're talking about the Tea Party. You're talking about the smearing of this person in this campaign. You're talking about, you know, everything that's going on now. These are all the elements of the Prohibition story. And you could, if the ghost of Al Smith could come back, he would say, what was said about me in the 1928 presidential race when you had a Catholic running for the first time for the highest office of the land and an avowed wet, the first time a politician had stepped forward in a national race to say, I'm wet. I'm not dry. I think this Prohibition is terrible. The opprobrium that was heaped on him makes some of the stuff today seem sometimes tame.
Do you see this headed, today's political climate, toward anything as concrete as Prohibition? That was a constitutional amendment.
Well, I think the lessons of Prohibition ought to remain in our minds, that every time we see a social ill, every time we find ourselves in that chasm looking on the two sides of a contentious issue, that the solution is not always to pass a law. In this case, 10% of our population has some problem with alcohol, but we decided to apply this solution to the other 90% as well, and it didn't work out. I mean, we created a criminal subclass. We had women alcoholism, and women rose tremendously when alcohol wasn't available. So, I mean, we had all these unintended consequences that are part of what I think makes the story of Prohibition so interesting.
Ken Burns, my guest on WNYC. So if you're going to launch a civility and democracy initiative, where does civility end and namby-pambyism begin?
No.
Deal with this question on the show because we so value civil discourse here. We come together every morning to do civil discourse, and yet where there is injustice, we want loud voices, not a polite dinner party, right?
Absolutely. And protest and dissent and redress of grievances is at the heart of who we are. Nobody wants to stifle that. What I think happens is that we begin to see, particularly in our fractured culture, in our diverse media, that some of this stuff pays, the vitriol pays. And there'd be people who make, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars a year who'd be out of business if we could continue to have a conversation, as people have on WNYC every single day, day in and day out, around the year. So we want to passionately believe in what we believe in. We want to fight for our rights. But I think what happens is we have the ability now to promote people who can say the worst sort of things and get away with it.
How many times in this film, this series on historical prohibition documentary, you know, as you say, is months away from actually airing. How many times you've been asked already if you see today's drug laws as the moral equivalent of prohibition?
You know, it's funny. It happens every single day, and you want to say, yes, I understand why you say that, and I sort of went in it thinking that maybe there'd be that. But it's a little bit different. There's many things that are very similar, but for the most part, alcohol is a cultural phenomenon around the world. Drugs are a subcultural phenomenon, and we're talking about something in which nearly everyone did, and then everyone was told they could not do. Drugs are a little bit different, so you can't sort of fit it precisely into it, but many of the same victimless crime arguments, many of the same lack of taxation. You know, beer and its related and liquor and its related industries were the fifth largest in the United States. All of a sudden, that tax revenue was gone. People went out of work, and it was the Depression that finally we said, look, we could use these jobs and we could use a drink.
as steeped in American history, by now as drenched in American history as you are, have we ever had an era of civil discourse?
I think we've had times when we've understood that the American genius had to do with compromise. And there have been times when our Congress has sort of gotten together and passed things. I mean, many of the great legislative activities of the 50s and 60s and early 70s came from bipartisan efforts on civil rights, on the environment, on other things in which you don't find, as you find today, it's all the Democrats on one side and all the Republicans on the other, and you can't find a single defector for what we usually do well, and that brings us to the Civil War, which is compromise. And the Civil War is the example that staring us in the face of what happens when you permit that rhetoric to sort of vibrate out of hand, and the fire eaters become firers of guns. There are Second Amendment remedies that are sort of put into practice with the Civil War.
Ken Burns, documentary filmmaker, my guest on WNYC. The Civil War. Is the Civil War over in cultural and political terms? Are the blue state, red state divisions of today an echo of the war between the blue and the gray?
Yes.
But without the guns?
Yes. Yes, of course. This is the most important event in American history. Everything that came before it led up to it. Almost inexorably, you wish that wasn't the case. And I suppose there were other times when you thought it could have been diverted, the compromise could have been worked out. But there were some things that were uncompromisable, and slavery was one of them, apparently. It still reverberates. I grew up of 2 to 10 in a semi-border state of Delaware where it was not uncommon to hear the N-word. It basically, I'm pleased to say, left the general speech patterns of the people I was around until recently.
Until recently.
Until recently, yeah. And now I hear it more and more, and it's disturbing. And it has to do entirely with the color of the skin of the man who is president of the United States.
Are you saying that you see racial overtones to the Tea Party movement other than fringe elements? That certainly has been a hotly debated question.
I don't know enough. I just know that I have, you know, enough anecdotal evidence of people who, I don't know, I don't check people's party credentials. That seems utterly un-American. But I just see, as someone who travels around the country and speaks to diverse groups and people of hugely varying political persuasions, just an increase in the volatility of rhetoric, the use of the N-word, of sort of strange perversions of history. You know, they find a kind of apocalyptic vision of what's going on now. And then you sort of point out that the era that they liked, when things got done, you know, interstate highways and putting men on the moon, were times when the marginal tax rate was 90%. And did you want to go back to that? You know, we're in many ways as individuals the least taxed people on earth. And yet there is so much foment that information accurate information is hard to come by. And that's part of discourse, that you want to have passionate debates, but you've got to have it knowing that Lexington and Concord are in the state of Massachusetts and not my home state of New Hampshire.
Can the Civil War ever end in the United States?
I don't think so, in a way, because it is so born of the differences that people continue in a kind of, you know, deep tribal voice, the differences that they try to perceive and distinguish between people of different skin color. That has to do, as we know from physiology, of just the most minor kind of gene variations, that we remain 99.99% exactly the same. But this will continue. We will always have the sense of otherness terrifying us, and we'll always have people in whose interest it is to set people who would naturally seem to be economic or social allies against one another. There's a great thing making the rounds of the internet that there's a three people sitting around a table, a billionaire, a tea partier, and a working guy. And there's 12 donuts on the table, and the billionaire takes 11, turns to the tea party guy and says, "Watch out, that guy's going to want part of your donut."
Ken Burns, my guest on WNYC. Comment from listener who started watching the rebroadcast of Civil War and says, "I was struck tonight by Europe's efforts to stop the war and keep getting cotton. Parallels to oil," she asks. "Did it have to be fought through?"
Yeah, it's so great. Plus ça change, you know, there's nothing new under the sun, Ecclesiastes says. Yeah, I was watching the same episode and thinking, oh my God, boy, did we dodge a bullet. Had not there been a stalemate at Antietam, the French and the British were really poised to come in. This is economics often trumps the buck. It's the economy, stupid, is often the default position. And for a long time, it seemed as if the economic needs of particularly British but also French mills would trump the sympathies. New York was itself, because of its interest in the capitalist activity of the United States, the broker for a lot of these activities, and had tremendous Southern sympathies. The blockade to them was an anathema, the naval blockade that kept that cotton from going out.
The draft riots.
But Antietam, which was a stalemate, still permitted Lincoln a victory in a way that he issued the Emancipation Proclamation, which didn't free a slave in any territory he controlled. It only freed slaves in territory he didn't control. It was a savvy political move. It mobilized hundreds of thousands of African Americans, but it had the political effect, the foreign policy effect, of freezing Britain and France, and suddenly even the mill workers were saying, there is a higher moral issue here. And it was a brilliant political move. And unless you understand the subtleties of Abraham Lincoln, you can be still furious with him for being tardy on complete emancipation.
So you were watching some of the live airing the other night?
It's so funny. I remember a middle-aged man and his sister told me once after the Civil War came out that they had an 85-year-old mother who went to bed usually at 7 o'clock, but she was staying up and watching the Civil War. And they were saying, Mom, we'll buy it for you and you can watch it. She goes, no, I want to watch when everyone else is. And so I did that the first time, and I thought, you know, it's been 20 and a half years. Let me go there. I mean, I see clips of it now and then, but it seems like both completely familiar and another animal and somebody else's.
Do you want to go back in? Have you ever revised any of it? You know, earlier in the show, we were talking about revisions to our historical understanding of Malcolm X through the Manning Marable book.
Yeah. Oh, boy, what an unbelievable, tragic story that is. No. You know, it's like a photo album. This is who I was as an artist back then. And maybe I don't like that paisley shirt or the wide flaring bell bottoms, but you don't take the picture out of the family album. You leave it in and say, and that's who I was. So the Civil War, that's, and not just who I was, that's who my brother Rick was, and that's who Jeffrey C. Ward, the writer, was, and Paul Barnes, the principal editor, was, and all of the people involved in that film.
You talk about the images. What was the oldest recorded image you found? Photography was so new at that time. I think started in the 1820s.
No, the 1839, I believe, is a rooftop view of Paris. I could be wrong. And that by the mid 50s, it was possible to have itinerant peddlers who would take photographs of people. And so in those, it was a great democratizing thing because only the rich could afford the formal portraits, painted portraits. But the everybody more or less could get their picture taken, and they're all very serious. So the Civil
New media as a democratizing tool. Here we are again.
Ça change. And what happens is with the Crimean War, but particularly the Civil War, our Civil War, it's an explosion. It's the first photographed war. And people are going to galleries and looking at horrible photographs and being both titillated and interested and drawn as we are, rubbernecking at the accident in the other lane. That's what photography did. It woke us up.
With the Civil War, you famously tried to tell the whole story of the war through the stories largely of individuals. Are you going at Vietnam the same way?
Yes. I mean, it will be quite different from that, just as our World War II was a bottom-up story of the Second World War told through the experiences of four towns. But we find that people talk about Vietnam all the time and know nothing about it, that they, you know, have no knowledge of the major battles, have no knowledge of the diplomatic, military, strategic stuff, and, of course, have sort of abbreviated even the most important aspects, the protest at home and the experience of young soldiers. So, yeah, we'll do our best to collect as many of those bottom-up experiences as we can, both at home. I mean, this is Vietnam, the war and the war against the war.
You're 57, I read.
Yes.
Do you feel a certain generational responsibility or at least generational pull to take Vietnam on?
I feel to some extent, yes. I was eligible for the draft. I had a high draft number. I missed it. I would have tried to be a conscientious objector or left, I suppose. I was very much opposed to the war. I at that point, I was living in Ann Arbor, Michigan. But it's more the sense that war is strangely revealing, not only of the worst of us, obviously, but quite often the best of us. And it's true in the Civil War. It's true in the Second World War. And Vietnam seemed something where we wanted to dive in before the people were at the very end of their lives, that we could get people in their 60s and 70s, not 80s and 90s, and try to wake up those ghosts and come to some terms with something that now, if we deal with it, is dealt only in shorthand.
Ken Burns, he's working on Prohibition. He's working on Vietnam. He's working on a civility and democracy initiative. Do you want people to go to any website in connection with that or anything?
No, I think if they stay tuned to PBS and the Prohibition, the National Constitution Center has a great website in Philadelphia, and we've been working with them. And so we want people to talk, and we want people to be passionate about what they believe, but we think that we can do it in a civil way.
Ken Burns, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.